So apologies to listeners for the show on the 27th of September 2019. We had a power failure in the previous show. Steph told us about when we arrived. It didn't really occur to me that it would knock out all of the ability to record or the listen again and the stream and everything, but apparently it did. But so here is the at least a compilation of the audio we used on that program. Martin and I started off by discussing the failure of the Washington to give visas to many of the senior Russians going, including their chairman of their Foreign Affairs Committee of the Russian government, and he wasn't allowed to go. And the Americans said, oh, we're not going to give you a visa to come to the UN. And we discussed the possibility of maybe the UN should be taking place somewhere else, like Geneva, not the US, not New York, because of the Americans abusing this stupid idea to allow stop people coming, like the Russians, who they don't like, and they're trying to blame for this, that, and everything else. So we started off actually looking at South America with a talk by Evo Morales, who's the Bolivian president, largely about that some of the reforms that he's been doing in his country and why. And then we also discussed on Bolivia the potential that Chile might give up some of its land, so Bolivia has got some access to the Pacific too. But anyway, here is now is Evo Morales, the president of Bolivia.
How have we managed to achieve so much in such a short period of time? How has Bolivia managed to take the path towards defeating poverty and underdevelopment? Well, thanks to the mindfulness of our people, of the indigenous social movements, of movements of farmers, of workers, of professionals, of men and women living in rural areas and in cities. We have nationalized our natural resources and our strategic businesses, taking control of our destiny. We have built a community-based socioeconomic model that is also productive and that acknowledges that basic services are a human right. Today, we can say with pride and optimism that Bolivia can look forward to its future.
Then, staying in the Americas, we heard from Peter Phillips at Sonoma University about the impeachment of Trump. We had quite a good look, actually, at, and it's on the show page at thisweek.org.uk, at this Joe Biden's son working for a gas company in Ukraine in 2014, which there was an attempt to prosecute the company, and apparently Biden's son put pressure on the chief prosecutor of Ukraine to drop the investigation. So this is what Trump is obviously interested in. We read out the transcript, and there's a link to that CNN article on our show page, and it really doesn't sound as if Trump is trying to put any pressure on or anything. This whole thing is just a completely confected story which has been taking up all the mass media's acres of news all week, pointlessly. So anyway, let's have a listen now to Peter Phillips from Sonoma State University, who runs something called, or did, he's a founder of Project Censored, looking forward to the possibility that Trump might be impeached.
I think the impeachment is going to, the nation was advocating quite strongly today that the impeachment focus on very narrow bounds of him violating the law by encouraging, you know, foreign officials to engage in political action and investigate Biden here in the United States, and then using military equipment processes to try to pressure that to happen. That's illegal. And if they focus just on that, they could probably impeach him and get him out really quickly. They should be able to do that.
So that was Peter Phillips, author of Giants of the Global Elite from Sonoma University and the US Project Censored, talking about the possible impeachment of Donald Trump. Then we went on to graver matters, really, I suppose, with Imran Khan talking about capitalism and what a disaster it's been and why it's a serious problem with so much money laundering going on in the City of London, although he doesn't specifically mention City of London. Anyone with half a brain cell knows the City of London is the capital of money laundering, but he very politely didn't mention them. But he's saying, you know, effectively that capitalism is the problem.
What I'm disappointed is that for some reason countries put their economic interests ahead of human beings. This is the same with climate change. Countries, because of not wanting to lose their growth rate, do not realize that what impending disaster this climate change is bringing to the world. Neither do countries, for instance, which I'll be speaking about, this money laundering which comes from the developing world into the rich countries every year. Billions and billions of dollars from poor countries moves to rich countries through corruption, ruling elites of third developing world, taking the money out. And unfortunately, because if anything, the richer countries gain from it, they do not take any steps to stop it. This is a plunder of the poor countries. The poor countries are getting poorer. The rich are getting richer. And these criminals who plunder the poor countries have an easy way of parking their money, buying flats in New York and London. And that's what we want. We want the world to take notice of this. The richer countries, they should have strong money laundering laws. They should, if we can identify that money has been stolen from our countries, it should be immediately given back to us. But this is the problem, because the laws are so complicated, and if the rich countries want, they can easily tighten the laws so that it will be the biggest deterrent for these criminals in third world to take the money out.
That's Imran Khan, Prime Minister of Pakistan. I think the star of the show, really. Actually, not Greta Thunberg, but he is, because of what he's saying here, many, many things he's been talking about, making a lot of sense. And he was talking there about capitalism. He talks here about the very serious situation with the potential nuclear conflict between Pakistan and India over Kashmir.
Look, I mean, if ever the Security Council has to move, it's now. And I'll say for two reasons. One, the people of Kashmir are suffering simply because the Security Council could not implement its decision to allow them the right of self-determination. The 11 resolutions. So it's their responsibility. 8 million people are locked inside for 50 days. It's inhuman. So what is the Security Council for then? Second, this has a potential of the unthinkable. Two nuclear armed countries face to face. Surely the Security Council came into being to stop this. I mean, this is as bad as it gets. Yeah. So here's me. The reason I started by saying I would not have come out of Pakistan, because, you know, we are just about coming out of a really difficult economic situation and governance issues and fighting a corrupt mafia. I would not have come here. But I'm alarmed, because here's me. There is one prime minister that side. There's one this side. You know, a sane mind can't think of a nuclear war. No sane mind can think of it. We grew up in after the Cuban crisis, and all of us sort of knew that the Cold War was there, because the other war was unimaginable. But when you have what you have in India right now, and I say this who knows India, this is an ideology, a racist ideology, which believes in the supremacy of a Hindu race. The other races are not supposed to be equal. How do you reason with them? How do you reason with what they've done in Kashmir? I mean, would you expect a civilized society to do what they've done? I'm locked in, 8 million people. So therefore, I'm worried that if this goes on, there can easily be a miscalculation. And that's why the United Nations must act.
That's the Pakistani Imran Khan, for me, the star so far of the UN General Assembly in New York, talking about Kashmir. So then we went on to look at Israel and the Middle Eastern conflict. And we start with the Foreign Ministry of Israel, Israel Katz.
The main problem threatening stability and security in the Middle East is Iran, which threatens to destroy Israel and works against the regimes of many countries in the region. Iran uses its proxy terror organizations, Hezbollah in Lebanon, Hamas and Palestinian Islamic Jihad in Gaza, the Houthis in Yemen, and Shiite militias in Syria and Iraq against Israel and also against other states in the Middle East. We recently saw a serious escalation in which Iranian missiles were launched from Iran against Saudi oil facilities in order to destabilize world oil supplies. This terror attack against Saudi Arabia was done on the direct orders of Iranian leader Ali Khamenei. Iran is the biggest terror state and the biggest sponsor of terror in the world. I call on the international community to unite in order to stop Iran. The world cannot allow Iran to develop nuclear weapons. The world cannot allow Iran to develop ballistic missiles, and the world must stop Iran from supporting terror organizations in the region. The UN must declare Hezbollah and the Iranian Revolutionary Guards as terror organizations. They promote terror in the Middle East, Europe, Latin America, and all over the world, and the world must stop them. I call on the international community to support President Trump's maximum pressure policy against Iran. This is the way to stop them. We must stop Iran today in order to prevent war tomorrow. And to the Iranian leadership, I say in their own language, Jujeu ohare poiz mishemoran. You don't count the birds till the end of the fall. It isn't over till it's over.
So that's the Israeli position from Israel Katz. We went straight on to listen to the Lebanese president, who is Michel Aoun. He's talking about the sort of problems that they're having in Lebanon, right next door with Israel.
Palestinian youth should become education candidates, not revenge candidates. So I would warn against any attempt to undermine or change UNRWA's mandate. And I call on the contributing countries to the budget of UNRWA to double their contributions in order to enable it to maintain its vital role. Mr. President, ladies and gentlemen, the Middle East crisis has been continuing now for decades and is becoming more complicated because all the approaches to a solution and all of the Israeli practices are in contradiction with the founding principles of the United Nations. Indeed, the Judaization of Jerusalem and the methodic colonial policy and legislation that contradicts human rights and the recognition of the annexation of lands that were occupied by force, as in the case of the Golan Heights, and also the electoral promises to annex new lands, and with all the leaks about the deal of the century, threatens the territorial unity of the country. In order to put an end to the Palestinian issue and keep the Palestinians where they are, Lebanon will suffer the effects of this because we host a large number of the refugees. And all of this undermines any chance for peace in the Middle East and points undoubtedly to a dark, unknown future. However, the rights of peoples remain, even when so much time passes by. Mr. President, ladies and gentlemen, the Israeli violations of Resolution 1701 have never ceased. And neither have the aggressions against Lebanese sovereignty by land, sea and air. The hostile act carried out last month against a residential area in the heart of Beirut is the most serious infringement of this resolution.
So from Michel Aoun, President of Lebanon, to Mahmoud Abbas, President of Palestine, which is a virtual state, really, because the Israelis aren't really allowing them to have a state. But Mahmoud Abbas had quite a lot to say about their situation, President of Palestine at the UN General Assembly in New York.
The peace that we strive for are now severely endangered as a result of the policies and practices of Israel in our occupied land and its reneging on signed agreements since the Oslo Accords in 1993 to the present date. The responsibility for defending and preserving international law and peace is incumbent upon you. Israel has not implemented any agreement, and we do hope that you compel Israel to respect international legitimacy. Ladies and gentlemen, in Jerusalem, the occupying power is waging a reckless, racist war against everything that is Palestinian, from the confiscation and demolition of homes to assaults on clergymen to the eviction of our citizens from their homes to attempts to violate the sanctity of the Holy Al-Aqsa Mosque and the Church of the Holy Sepulchre to the legislation of racist laws. The national Jewish state law, these laws and these practices, we all thought that they ended with the apartheid in South Africa. We see that today we have similar laws, a similar law in Israel discriminating against people based on their nationality and their race, and the world remains silent before these practices. They are denying worshippers access to the holy places. I caution against these policies and reckless measures, which will lead to dangerous consequences with unfathomable implications. The result will be a religious war. We want to avoid such a war, but Israel is making every effort to reach and to wage such a religious war. Israel, for months, has been confiscating a part of our returns. They are withholding our revenues, which is deepening the suffering of our people and preventing us from fulfilling our financial obligations towards them. This also exacerbates the economic crisis our country is enduring due to a lack of resources and the decision by some parties and countries to suspend their commitments towards us. Yet, the Palestinian people will not surrender to the Israeli occupation, regardless of the circumstances and no matter the pain, and will remain steadfast on their land, resisting occupation by all available means. Foremost, peaceful, popular resistance. This is our legitimate right and our national and moral obligation. Let everyone know that occupation cannot bring peace or security or stability for anyone. Israel must not think that through occupation it can achieve peace on its land. This will not happen. Ladies and gentlemen, what is unfortunate and shocking is that the U.S. administration, a permanent member of the Security Council, instead of maintaining international peace and security and upholding UN resolutions, instead, it is supporting the Israeli aggression against us, reneging on its international, political, legal, and moral obligations. The U.S. administration has even undertaken extremely aggressive and unlawful measures, declaring Jerusalem as the so-called capital of Israel and moving its embassy there. in a blatant provocation to the sentiments of hundreds of millions of Muslims and Christians for whom Jerusalem is a central part of their religious faith. Jerusalem will remain. Despite all of these measures, Jerusalem will remain the eternal capital of Palestine, regardless of any schemes or actions.
So that was Mahmoud Abbas, the President of Palestine. We heard then from President Rouhani from Iran about the Americans dropping out of the JCPOA, or the Iran nuclear deal.
Ladies and gentlemen, the attitude of the incumbent U.S. government towards the nuclear deal or the JCPOA not only violates the provisions of the United Nations Security Council Resolution 2231, but also constitutes a breach of the sovereignty and political and economic independence of all of the world's countries. In spite of the American withdrawal from the JCPOA, and for 1 year, Iran remained fully faithful to all of its nuclear commitments in accordance with the JCPOA. Out of respect for the Security Council resolution, we provided Europe with the opportunity to fulfill its 11 commitments made to compensate for the U.S. withdrawal. However, unfortunately, we only heard beautiful words while witnessing no effective measures.
Iranian President Rouhani talking about the U.S. dropping out of the JCPOA. We had a discussion about the Europeans also threatening now to pull out if Iran did anything which was outside the JCPOA, even though, of course, they aren't trading with Iran. They've given into American sanctions, and so the EU is now threatening to pull out of the JCPOA too. And this, of course, it means really that the EU is just doing what the Americans want, and there's no real independent ideas at all. And so then we now listen to the Scandinavian star of the UN, which is, of course, Greta Thunberg, talking about the climate crisis.
This is all wrong. I shouldn't be up here. I should be back in school on the other side of the ocean. Yet you all come to us young people for hope. How dare you? You have stolen my dreams and my childhood with your empty words. And yet I'm one of the lucky ones. People are suffering. People are dying. Entire ecosystems are collapsing. We are in the beginning of a mass extinction, and all you can talk about is money and fairy tales of eternal economic growth. How dare you? For more than 30 years, the science has been crystal clear. How dare you continue to look away? And come here saying that you're doing enough when the politics and solutions needed are still nowhere in sight. You say you hear us and that you understand the urgency. But no matter how sad and angry I am, I do not want to believe that. Because if you really understood the situation and still kept on failing to act, then you would be evil, and that I refuse to believe. You are failing us, but the young people are starting to understand your betrayal. The eyes of all future generations are upon you. And if you choose to fail us, I say we will never forgive you. We will not let you get away with this. Right here, right now, is where we draw the line. The world is waking up, and change is coming, whether you like it or not. Thank you.
Greta Thunberg talking about the climate crisis at the UN 2019 General Assembly in New York. Martin commented, I remember that actually the real threat was not climate, it was nuclear war. And of course, many people think similar things. So we go on now, finally, to have a listen to the British contribution at the United Nations General Assembly, hoping, of course, to have some next week too. Other people, other presidents, other prime ministers speaking there. And we finish with Boris Johnson, who gave quite a speech about artificial intelligence. And here is a clip from that. Although, of course, this wasn't really that serious a talk about global geopolitics, it is interesting, but in a way he's kind of distracting from the fact that Britain, America and Israel seem to be causing all the problems in the world.
You may keep your secrets from your friends, from your parents, your children, your doctor, even your personal trainer. But it takes real effort to conceal your thoughts from Google. And if that is true today, in future, there may be nowhere to hide. Smart cities will pullulate with sensors, all joined together by the Internet of Things. Bollards communing invisibly with lampposts, so there is always a parking space for your electric car, so that no bin goes unemptied, no street unswept, and the urban environment is as antiseptic as a Zurich pharmacy. But this technology could also be used to keep every citizen under round-the-clock surveillance. A future Alexa will pretend to take orders, but this Alexa will be watching you, clucking her tongue and stamping her foot. In future, voice connectivity will be in every room and almost every object. Your mattress will monitor your nightmares. Your fridge will beep for more cheese. Your front door will sweep wide the moment you approach like some silent butler. Your smart meter will go hustling of its own accord for the cheapest electricity, and every one of them minutely transcribing your every habit in tiny electronic shorthand stored not in their chips or in their innards, nowhere you can find it, but in some great cloud of data that lowers ever more oppressively over the human race. A giant dark thundercloud waiting to burst, and we have no control over how or when the precipitation will take place. And every day that we tap on our phones or work on our iPads, as I see some of you are doing now, we not only leave our indelible spore in the ether, but we are ourselves becoming a resource, click by click, tap by tap, just as the Carboniferous period created the indescribable wealth, leaf by decaying leaf, of hydrocarbons. Data is the crude oil of the modern economy, and we're now in an environment where we don't know who should own these new oil fields. We don't know who should have the rights or the title to these gushers of cash, and we don't know who decides how to use that data. And can these algorithms be trusted with our lives and hopes? Should the machines, and only the machines, decide whether or not we are eligible for a mortgage or insurance, or what surgery or medicines we should receive? Are we doomed to a cold and heartless future in which computer says yes or computer says no, with the grim finality of an emperor in the arena? How do you plead with an algorithm? How do you get it to see extenuating circumstances? And how do we know that the machines have not been insidiously programmed to fool us or even to cheat us? We're already using all kinds of messaging services that offer instant communication at minimal cost. And these same programs, platforms, could also be designed for real-time censorship of every conversation, with offending words automatically deleted. Indeed, in some countries, this happens today.
So that was the British Prime Minister Boris Johnson at New York for the General Assembly of the United Nations. Sorry about this week's show having no actual chat that was on the programme due to a multiple technical failure at the BCFM studio. We had a power cut just before we came on in here in the previous show. Hope to be back as normal, folks. next week. The show page, of course, is at thisweek.org.uk, where you'll find links to many of these stories, including the two, I suppose, quite big scandals that we've dug up this week. One is the Tory donor, who is the guy who was supposedly bailing out the Thomas Cook travel company, but actually was also secretly, or not so secretly, betting $250 million in derivatives, credit default swaps, that the company would collapse. His hedge fund's called CQS Management, and he's the Tory donor, Michael Hintze, H-I-N-T-Z-E. We're online at thisweek.org.uk, and don't let the banksters get you down.
Just love the greater wars and a shallower recovery. You see the recovery always comes round again. There's nothing to worry for, things look after themselves. It's alright, recovery always comes round again. There's nothing to worry for, things can only get better. There's only lose their jobs, their homes, and sometimes their sense. There's only millions that die in their bloody wars. It's alright. It's only their lives and the lives of their next of kin that they are losing. It's only their lives and the lives of their next of kin that they are losing. It's alright, cause the historical pattern has shown how the economic tends to revolve in a round of decades. Three stages stand out in a loop. A stubborn war then yield back to square one, back to more. Bigger slump and bigger wars and a smaller recovery. Huger slump and greater wars and a shallower recovery. Don't worry, be happy, things will get better.
On some F-Fold tomorrow. Well, I went to the social just to get a little pension. I was sorely in distress, I was needing some attention. They said, you don't get a qualified, don't get a dime. That's why I broke your jaw, that's why I'm doing time. But it takes a lot of blue backs to satisfy my heart. Get my hands on some F-Fold tomorrow. lawyer in the city. He said, you're gonna come and see me, boy, it really is a pity. Those savings he got in the casino disappeared. And he went out the window real quick, honey. And I'll do it all again, but it may sound funny if I could get my hands on some F-old money. I could get my hands on some F-old money. Just to raise a little money. He said, I'm glad to see it, but I started feeling funny. He said, you ain't got a house, you ain't got a job, I ain't got a window, and I ain't got a plot. It takes a lot of blue backs to satisfy my honey. I could get my hands on some F-old money. F-old money. F-old money.